This is Across Divides, a series of stories and experiences from communities across the island of Ireland as they meet shared challenges and consider opportunities for collaboration. Find out more at icommunityhub.org. Across the island, rural communities face similar challenges of supporting livelihoods, out-migration, and digital connectivity, to name a few. I'm Alex McMaster, and in today's episode, we'll take a look at rural communities as vibrant places and ways that they can be connected. I'm joined today online by Kate Clifford, CEO of Rural Community Network, a regional voluntary membership-based organisation supporting rural communities across Northern Ireland. Tara O'Farrell is also joining us from Longford Women's Link, which aims to link women with resources to help improve and change their own and their families' lives, providing a knock-on transformative effect on the local community. And originally from Belfast, but joining us now from Austin in Texas, is community activist and researcher Emma Shaw. Emma's research focuses on underachievement in education, especially among low-income students. Thank you all for joining us today, and we're looking forward to a really interesting conversation. I'd like to start off actually with Kate and ask you quite a generic question, I guess, on the topic around the challenges that are facing rural communities across the island.
I think communities right across the island of Ireland are feeling isolated. Start with a negative. Let's start with a positive. So rural areas are fantastic places to live. Strong sense of community, strong sense of place, strong sense of identity. Very supportive communities working hard, pulling together to make a difference in their area. The reality for many is that life is a struggle. They lack community services. They lack equal access to services. Very often they are areas that are neglected. They suffer out-migration. And inward investment is not something that happens very easily in rural areas. When you then overlap that with a huge digital divide, which comes from the lack of investment in infrastructure, which comes from a lack of innovation and risk-taking within governments, you then create areas which are, if you like, backward in reality in relation to their urban counterparts. We believe that digital technology could unlock the potential of very many very good rural communities. There's an emphasis on self-help. There's an emphasis on empowerment. Communities coming together to a very positive change, whether that's building sports clubs, whether it's addressing the issues around the elderly in their community, whether it's about saving post offices or saving retaining services such as banks or retaining small businesses and small shops. The issue for us in terms of the digital exclusion is that society is now digital by default, and digital services are digital accessibility. So should you need to claim for your benefits, should you need to look for particular types of government services, all of that information is now online. The really difficult structure has been that lack of investment in key infrastructure to enable affordable, accessible, reliable broadband into communities. That is being unlocked slowly, but it is a very slow transformation. So I live in a community, and even today we've had difficulty connecting me online, but I live in an area where I now pay for two broadband service providers. So I have BT to one side of my house, and then I have a Wi-Fi connection on the side of my house, which is run off a satellite. That's expensive. Now, I'm in a position where I can afford that, but there are many families out there who can't afford to get the first connection. And neither of those connections is sufficient to carry Zoom calls at home.
Thank you, Kate. And we've kind of, I guess you've gone there into the digital side of things, which is something that we really, really want to come into. I'd just like, before we go into more detail on it, to come around to Tara and kind of introduce a bit of your work. And also, I guess, to look at some of the wider issues that we see when we look at the kind of rural-urban divide and what challenges are kind of being faced in the rural community, and also how the kind of work that you've been doing has been addressing that, because I know that your organisation has been evolving through time, and I guess at the moment
we're facing this, and as Kate has mentioned, you know, we're facing this kind of issue of digital inclusion and digital connectivity, and this is something that's been particularly relevant at the moment with the COVID pandemic. But in the past, and kind of how those kind of connectivity issues have evolved, how have you seen those challenges sort of that are faced by rural communities, and how have you been able to address them through your organisation?
Thanks very much, Alex. And we are a social enterprise based in Longford Town in the Midlands. And we have a wide range of services, including training and education and a domestic violence service. And I'll just talk about those two briefly because I think they really speak to your point. And we would recognise an awful lot of what Kate is saying in terms of the connectivity and the digital divide. So even, you know, before COVID and during COVID, and we now have a very complex new landscape as we come out of COVID, and even some would say we're still operating against a backdrop of COVID. So I suppose the pre-COVID normal, if you like, for many of our learners and many of the women who come through our door would involve a range of social issues. So, you know, there's such a diversity of learner experiences, such a diversity of experiences from the women who walk through our doors. So many of the issues are not new. So the issue of connectivity is not new. The issue of domestic violence is not new. The issue of educational inequality is not new. But what has happened over the past 2 years is that these issues have become more visible, particularly in the pandemic. So whatever our new landscape looks like, it needs to have, you know, equality-proofed systems and processes for learners and for women who come into us. So we would obviously see the same challenges in terms of broadband. And we've surveyed our learners twice during the pandemic, first at the very start when we were migrating all of our courses online, and then more recently before Christmas to see how they were coping with the ongoing online education. And a lot of people will say, yes, we have internet access. Yes, we have broadband. But as Kate has said, it's not reliable. Now, I'm coming today from Roscommon, and I've been lucky enough to be able to get onto the new fibre broadband system. So I actually have a very, very good connection. A couple of miles down the road in maybe more urban areas, there isn't the same connectivity, nor is there the possibility to get the same connectivity for another year or two. So it's very, very uneven. But a lot of our learners will talk about the impact that the lack of reliable broadband has on them. So they're trying to catch up on classes, or they're missing classes. Then they're trying to do, as Kate has said, you know, purchase additional Wi-Fi. So if they can afford it, that's one thing. But if they can't, then they're at a disadvantage again. Or they're moving house, they're going over to a neighbor's house or to a friend's house just to be able to catch up on learning. The other issue that we've seen, and there's been a huge amount of coverage about this, is the issue of domestic violence. And there's a very, very different reality for women who are living with domestic violence in rural communities right across the island. And, you know, many of us that live in rural areas, sometimes there's this lovely romantic notion, this idyllic notion of living in rural Ireland. And I live in rural Ireland and I absolutely love it. There's huge positives. There's that great community spirit. But sometimes that community spirit that we think is so positive can actually enable the behaviours of a lot of perpetrators. So as we know that, you know, if you're living in a rural area, you are much more isolated. You don't have access to the broadband, to perhaps good mobile phone coverage if you need to make a call or use WhatsApp, for example. You've limited access to services. There's a lot more dangers in rural areas in terms of if you're living within a farming situation and access to implements and machinery and all of that. And there's a lot more stresses in terms of lower incomes and that general feeling of isolation. So for us, we would see a lot of differences between the rural and the urban. And it's not to say that people living in urban communities don't have issues and problems to deal with. Of course they do. But that isolation, that lack of connectivity is something that we have found really, really intrinsic in the fabric of rural communities. And in terms of solutions, like, for example, we have things like laptop loan schemes that were made possible through the Mitigating Against Educational Disadvantage Fund. And we worked a lot with AINTHIS, who is an adult learning organisation with membership right across the island. And it's been fantastic. It's been great to be able to have those laptops, to be able to lend out to learners who don't have access to them. But the laptop doesn't pick up the phone and inquire how the learner is doing. The laptop doesn't pick up the phone and support a student who might be struggling with lack of confidence or struggling with isolation or struggling with, you know, with an assignment. So while the digital is really important, and I think it's important to acknowledge that it has brought a lot of opportunity in terms of even being able to do this online today is really important. And it has cut down on a lot of travel. And, you know, we're talking about sustainability, that's really important. But we cannot lose sight of that one-to-one connection, that social interaction. And that's one of the things that our learners will say to us, that the online is great and it's very accessible and it has allowed them to continue their learning, but it doesn't replace the interactive, that one-to-one connection that is really, really important for society.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you've kind of come round there to the sort of educational side of engaging with digital connections, and that is one of many examples of situations that exist on both sides of, if we look at a divide between rural and urban communities. And Emma, I think that, you know, you have experience of very much in the sphere of educational inclusion, and this is really where your research focuses. And you also, I suppose, have experience of bridging these kinds of divides, whether it be that kind of rural-urban divide or whether it be divides between different traditions on the island. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how we can kind of learn from bridging some divides in order to bridge others, if that's something you'd be happy to comment on.
Mm-hmm. So firstly, thank you for inviting me to speak with these fantastic women today. I just really wanted to touch on something that they both commented on, was the affordability and reliability of broadband, because that typically also affects low-income families and low-income students, regardless of whether they live in an urban area or a rural area. And that was something that became really apparent as well during the pandemic. A lot of schools were able to issue laptops. But what schools weren't able to do was ensure that the home had sufficient broadband connectivity. And so certainly in the area that I was working in, whilst we gave out laptops and whilst we made laptops accessible through the school, some students were still not able to connect through the laptop because of broadband connections with their house, whether they were in a one parent family or a low income. So we had those sort of connectivity issues as well. The other thing then, also in terms of accessing the know-how, what we notice in certainly the women that I have, the women that I've interviewed and taken on board their viewpoints, what they're saying to me is it's great to have all of these courses and it's great to have these education, but if they're not at a time that's accessible to them, so a lot of times the courses are run during the day. And so if a woman is working in a low income job but can't take time off that job to then attend courses to better move into whatever area they want to. And even when there's courses in the evening, they don't necessarily have a creche facility or other barriers to engagement within that particular area. Also then, just on another point, in terms of the lack of confidence for students, we've seen that absolutely skyrocket during COVID. Before COVID, it was also an issue. In my undergrad research, a lot of the students, the young people that I spoke to, age 11 to 16, I spoke with 546 young people, and they said they didn't see people like them in higher and further education. And that was one of the barriers. From my own perspective growing up, I had always thought young people don't do it because it's a financial barrier. But whenever I actually engaged with the young people, they didn't want to see, or they didn't see people like them going to higher and further education. And so in terms of collaboration, I have actually founded a nonprofit in East Belfast that looks at educational underachievement, and we're working to put some programs together, and we are working with partners. Tara mentioned Eantas. We've partnered with them. We've also connected with a Desh school down in Dublin. We've got some connections in Ballyclare and across in England as well. So it is about building a community that transcends these boundaries that we put ourselves in, especially in the context of the conflict within Northern Ireland. When we talk about traditions, women's groups and women's centres are fantastic at reaching out across that divide into communities. We do a lot of work together in terms of education, community development, building women's skills up, and that's fantastic work. What we're trying to do within our nonprofit is to expand that really positive transformational work to include young people and older men as well, to do an intergenerational approach to educational underachievement and connect people to the resources that they feel that they need. So instead of saying this is our programs, this is what we're going to do, we want to try and meet people where they're at.
And I guess, Emma, you've introduced that concept of collaboration really there and the necessity for it, whether it be across a variety of different divides and also, I guess, in a geographical sense and across different challenges that people are facing. And I'd just like to come round to both Kate and Tara, because you are both your organisations are signatories on the new Common Charter for collaboration across and between these islands. This is an initiative to empower civic society to drive cross-border, north and south, east and west cooperation across the island. And I wondered if you would mind talking a little bit about how that structure, which has been kind of put together and has allowed organisations to collaborate and network, how that has really worked on the ground for you and how it's been able to help build up the work that you're doing? Either of you.
Okay, so Tara. Maybe... sorry.
Yeah, I'm happy to start. I suppose we've been involved with the Centre for Cross-Border Studies since 2015, and it is a question you often get asked as somebody who's working with an organisation in Longford from Roscommon and the west of Ireland, going, what prompted you or what encouraged you to get involved on a cross-border, all-island collaborative basis? And the simple reason is because we should be doing it. And for us, I suppose we've always recognised in all of the work that we've been doing over the number of years that we've been in existence, is there is that need for grassroots groups to be able to come together on an all-island basis and talk about our shared challenges and have the conversations. They're not always easy conversations. And during the development of the new Common Charter, some of the conversations were challenging, but they were always respectful. Everyone brought a great deal of generosity to the table in terms of, you know, what they were willing to share, what they were willing to discuss. But I think there was always a willingness to listen and to hear others' views and to hear others' experiences and exchange that knowledge of good practices. So, you know, when we're talking about the charter itself, we're talking about, you know, increasing that opportunity to share information, promoting those civil society values and, you know, contributing to that shared experience. And we're involved in a number of different cross-border programs, one with Women's Tech in Belfast, which is looking at women in non-traditional spaces. And we have a program looking at women in local democracy, which is, as we know from the statistics, a non-traditional space for many women. So we've made and forged some very, very strong relationships. We have another program with the Northern Ireland Rural Women's Network, which has started this year through the Department of Foreign Affairs, which is called From Grassroots to Government. And that's again about supporting women to find their voice and to be able to advocate for change, looking at the local structures. So it's really, really important that we engage in this, and not just because of Brexit and all that has gone on with that, but because we are all living on this shared island. We have a wide range of common issues and a lot of knowledge, a lot of mutual knowledge that can be shared for the betterment of our rural communities on the island.
Kate, just I guess carrying on from with the Common Charter, it's such a kind of it seems from what Tara's just said, you know, such a strong force for collaboration. I wonder, could you talk a little bit about how long it actually took to get this off the ground and why it's so important now that it does exist?
Okay, I'm going to let Tara answer that because I'm a newcomer to the Common Charter, so I'm going to let Tara answer the formation of it.
Okay, absolutely. Tara, if that's okay.
It took quite a while, and I suppose an important point to note is that it did start before the Brexit vote. So I think it's really important to note that recognition. So as I said, we started working with the Centre for Cross-Border Studies on this back in 2015. And we had a number of meetings on a cross-border basis. Then we had meetings on an east-west basis with groups from Scotland and from Wales and from England. Then we did a tour of the various decision-making bodies. So we presented to IRACT, the subcommittees. We presented it over to the Scottish Parliament. We presented it over in London, in the House of Parliament there, and really trying to build support for it. So there, you know, there is a lot of support for it. I mean, there has been no other space for grassroots organisations to engage in this level of dialogue. So it was really important that we were able to do this on a north-south and an east-west basis, you know, always with that spirit of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement underpinning everything that we were doing. So it did take a couple of years of quite intense work, but I just felt it was really, really rewarding. And now we have this charter that many organisations have signed up to, you know, including ourselves and organisations that we work with, many organisations in Ireland, many all-Ireland organisations. So I think it's a real testimony to the work that went into it from those grassroots groups who, as I said, were very generous with their time and their input into the various discussions.
I was going to come in there because Tara has raised something really important to us, which was around, we are a peace building organization, and a big part of the work we do is investment in relationships. It's about difficult dialogue. It's about hard conversations. It's about trying to unpick the damage that has been done in this on these islands between communities, but also understanding that there is a strength in coming together, there's a strength in working together, and that we know where there is good civic dialogue, good civic engagement, and where there is a desire to understand each other, that we build stronger peace. And that's really, really fun to the work that we do as an organisation. So while the Common Charter was developed long before Brexit happened, absolutely sustain the element of the Good Friday Agreement that said that there'd be better and stronger relations, and it would maintain relations between North and South and East and West. So nobody was having to choose whether they were going with one body or another, and there was no superiority of one over another, but that there was equal measure being given to North and South, East and West relations. That has become absolutely essential in the work that we do now. It solidified commitment on our behalf as an organisation to sustain those relations long term. We know the benefit of those relations. We know the benefit of working strongly in collaboration with other community development activists, watching what others are doing in terms of unpicking some of the difficulties that we all face, the commonalities that we have, and working together in collaboration to resolve those issues, but also learning from each other, undertaking reflective practice together, and then also working to invest in our communities in a way that supports and consolidates the relations North and South, East and West. A big example of that would be some of the stuff that's going on in Scotland around community wealth building, some of the social value stuff that's going on in the south of Ireland. And we as an organisation then are tapping into our brother and sister organisations in other jurisdictions and saying, what do you know about this? How have you managed it? How are you negotiating this? And then we are all facing a common climate change. We're all facing common challenges around gender and inequality issues. And so the more we can work together, the more we can learn together, and the stronger our voice and the more vocal we are together, the better a chance we have. The Common Charter is a way of underpinning our work, but underpinning it in a way that is collaborative with these islands, that says this is something worth putting your shoulder. And while it's written as a charter, it's not set in stone. It is something that can bend and flex and change as we need it to. And so it should be revised. It should be a living document. And it's a strong way of underpinning the work that we do.
Emma, I think I'll just direct that back towards you. Because, I mean, you've mentioned just now, Kate, you mentioned community wealth building and policy, and I guess how those, I guess, working from both ends, or both from the bottom up and then from the top down, I guess, in two different senses. And we're looking at how, you know, communities can be directly can be empowered to make those kind of decisions that address things like the rural urban divide, or that address issues in rural connectivity. And, you know, through either of those kind of approaches, people's voices can be lost, or some voices can be heard and others not. And I wondered, Emma, if you could introduce to us a bit more how we kind of ensure that that inclusion is achieved in addressing the issues that have already been raised. You know, we've already looked at quite a few issues here, not just digital connectivity, but also we've looked at domestic violence and we've looked at education. And, you know, if voices aren't properly heard, what the consequences of that are, and also how those voices can be heard and how change can be equitable in that sense.
Thank you. Sorry, my throat. So in terms of my research is very much based on the framework of participatory action research. And what that means is engaging with the communities who are actually affected by the issues. And we have seen decades of poorly constructed policy because it doesn't engage with the people that it's impacting or affecting. We've seen it with universal credit. We've seen it with the so-called bedroom tax and the rape clause within universal credit. We've seen a number of really poorly constructed policy avenues. And this is because government and those making the policy have not engaged with the groups that the policy is supposed to be written to help. So my master's is in education policy and we look at implementation. And we know that the more people are engaged in the process when the policy is being created, that the more successful it can be at the implementation stage. So especially when we look at particular groups of people, we talk about domestic violence survivors. I just also want to note that I don't think anybody is actually voiceless or doesn't have a voice. It's that those voices are blocked out, whether by gatekeepers, whether by society, whether by these invisible barriers that we just can't seem to break through. And as a grassroots level worker, I really struggled to get access to some of those decision makers. It wasn't until I went on to higher and further education where I was able to use networks to be able to become introduced to different people, to be able to be introduced to politicians and the committees that they. And so it's not the people in the grassroots movement don't have a voice or don't have ideas. Is that they don't have the same access to resource ideas, those ideas into fruition.
Yeah. Absolutely. I wonder, just kind of looking at if people are not having, I guess, an outlet to voice those ideas and opinions and those viewpoints and those kind of those life situations that perhaps are not widely enough recognized, not widely enough addressed, whether it be from a grassroots or a policy perspective. I wonder, Emma or anyone else here, whether you could kind of talk a little bit about how those kind of issues can be addressed.
I'll just touch on one point. When we talk about women having the confidence to speak out, we have to also acknowledge the abuse that women face online on platforms when they do speak out. So I've contributed to a blog on Twitter with called Her Loyal Voice. It's for women that identify as loyalists. And one of my colleagues who also contributes has faced an absolute barrage of what can only be described as hate and abuse. You know, in terms of what she looks like, in terms of every other thing, even when she shared pictures of her family, these trolls on Twitter have went after her family. So we have to change society and make society a safer place for women to feel confident that they can speak out without getting this backlash, not only just on the theoretical space online. But we know that violence against women hasn't gone away. You know, it's become more apparent across COVID how many women have been murdered, not only by their partners, but also ex-partners. And there's new legislation that's been brought into Northern Ireland to bring it up to the standard of the rest of the United Kingdom and Ireland in terms of stalking legislation. But there is a lot more work that needs to be done. And that is why a lot of women don't speak out, because they, you know, we have to consider our mental mental health too. When we're speaking out, we have to consider the impact it's having on not just us, but our families, and how we choose to identify. I've developed a thicker skin when I've been speaking out over these last couple of years, but I still get, I've been told to stick to wearing makeup and taking selfies whenever I wrote an article for an Irish journal. And it's those kinds of things. I'm a little bit more, I've developed a thicker skin. Other younger women, when I'm speaking to them and trying to encourage them to speak out, that why would I speak out when I'm just going to be persecuted or ridiculed? And sometimes the media plays a part in that as well, when they portray loyalists in a particular fashion, instead of, you know, talking about the arguments, talking about the policy, not attacking the person.
When we're looking at any of these issues, ensuring that there is enough inclusion, especially for marginalised groups, both in urban and rural areas, is absolutely essential if there's going to be an equitable outcome for any kind of attempt at addressing any of the issues that we've talked about. Tara, Long for Women's Link is looking at equipping people with the resources to change their own lives and have those transformative knock-on effects for the rest of the community. And, you know, those resources and these programs that you're running are kind of aimed exactly at addressing the kind of issues that Emma and Kate have been talking about. I wondered if you could talk in a little bit more detail about those, and also what the success actually looks like, because we've seen how much, you know, what the underlying issues are and what the challenges, and obviously we haven't seen all of them. We've touched on some of the challenges that there are for addressing a lot of these issues, and what makes it really difficult, and what divides exist within the attempts to address these challenges. Could you just, talk a little bit about the way that you're addressing them and what that success actually then looks like.
I mean, I'll give you, I suppose, one of the clearest examples is back in 2009, we had the local council elections in Longford. And there was a group of women within Longford Women's Link who really felt, I suppose, completely fed up that they had no say, they had no part in the decisions that were being made at local level that were impacting themselves and their families and their wider communities. So we established what became the Longford Women's Manifesto Group. And really what it was about was absolutely advocating for more women to run for election. I'll come to that in a minute. But really it was about looking at the local structures. What are the local decision-making structures? How are decisions being made that are impacting me and my family and my community? And what we did was start to look at those structures and see how we could gain representation on them. So over the last number of years, we've gained representation through the various different structures on those decision-making committees. And for us, that's what success starts to look like, is that you are not just outside now, you are at the table, understanding how decisions are being made and being able to have some kind of a say. I'm not saying that, you know, you're always going to have huge influence, but to be at the table. And I mean, it speaks back to the previous points around the voices of women. And just to be clear, you know, we all know women are not a homogenous group. And, you know, we've an underrepresentation of women in decision making. But there are many women who have never accessed any platforms, whether it's political or public or otherwise, and who absolutely have a voice, but it's not being heard. So when we are at the table, and we are fortunate enough to have been able to access those spaces, we have to ask the question, who's not with us? So where are the traveller women, the disabled women, the women from rural communities, the migrant women, and so on? And women who have spent years supporting and often leading communities that are already marginalised and who now are bearing the brunt of a lot of tension and unrest. So I think for us, it's been very important to identify where are the structures, how can we affect change, and then how can we support women to access those structures. So then a couple of years ago, we established the SHE project with 5050 Northwest, and that stands for See Her Elected. And we were really getting into our stride at the beginning of 2020, and we had a great program of events for the year, and then obviously COVID arrived. But I suppose we made an opportunity out of the crisis, and we transferred a lot of our programs online. So the She School was born. And we've had over 700 women accessing programs on political education, but not just political education. Women want to know more about the housing system, the financial systems, you know, economics, pensions, domestic violence, all of that. So we're responding to the need that we've identified within communities, and it is rural communities right across Ireland, in terms of what women want to know about and how they want to affect change and what kind of changes they want to see. So you have to start by meeting people where they're at, understanding what it is that they want to know about, that they want to discuss, that they want to get involved in. And it's really important that it's a grassroots and bottom-up approach, that it's not Longford Women's Link or whatever organisation coming in and saying, here's our programme of events, this is what we think you should be talking about. It has to come from the groups themselves. And I think that's the only way that you get real representative voice within communities that can affect change. So what we want to see are more women sitting around the tables. We want to see government departments engaging with civic society organisations who are working with women, and meaningful engagement, not just, you know, a consultation emailed at the last minute saying, here's this link and, you know, fill it out and have it back to us within 2 days. That's not meaningful consultation. You know, burying consultation notices at the back of a local paper, that's not meaningful consultation. Really speaking to the civil society organisations who have the access to that grassroots group, and then creating that critical mass of women.
And do you think that is, and to any of you, do you think that's something that's taking place and something that is now affecting change?
I was just going to follow on with what Tara mentioned in terms of the grassroots level. And I do think that's incredibly important. I mean, in my work, I talk about organisations being community focused, community based and community led, because it's individual communities that know where they're at. As both Tara and Kate both said, we are not this homogenous group of women or people across this island, and indeed these islands. We all have our own different opinions. We can have different opinions that can be fully valid. It doesn't mean we can't speak to each other. It doesn't mean we can't engage with each other. And it's really important for us to foster these voices of young people and young women coming through, to be able to guide them how they can take the steps to get to the table where we've been lucky to be able to grab that seat and pull up at the table. And, you know, my granny always used to say, if you're not given a seat at the table, bring your own seat.
Classic. Kate, I wondered, just following on from what Emma said, whether you have anything you want to add there, or if you have any examples of what that kind of, I guess, giving people that seat at the table would look like, and what that kind of movement forward and success would look like.
Okay, I think there's communities either opposed or looking for changes within their areas. I think I've recently been involved in a number of projects right across Northern Ireland, which have put people with lived experience at the forefront of the conversations. So not asking in generalistic terms the organisation about what the difference is to this person's life, but actually asking the person themselves about what change has been affected as a result of X intervention. And the art of storytelling has become a hugely important part of what we do. I think fundamental to all that's been talked about today is the notion of community development and the principles of community development, which are very much about working alongside a community, starting with where they're at, looking to see what their ambitions are, looking to see what their needs are, understanding their needs and their wants and how they differentiate, and then working with communities around what are the barriers to their involvement and their inclusion, and then looking around to see who's not at the table and why they don't have a seat at that table, and encouraging those community groups to reach beyond the usual suspect and looking to see those people who are less visible or less vocal in the community, who have less of a voice or haven't been given that voice, and asking them, just exactly what Emma has said, to pull up their own chair, sit at the table and tell their stories, and then affect change from the lived experience. I think there's a huge level of what we do, all of us as organisations, is around that community development approach. We have a community group up the road from us here in Mid-Ulster. They had a planning application for a number of wind turbines to come into their area. There was a, you know, mass development of wind turbines for that community. Our organisation has supported groups to put up wind turbines, and we've supported groups to take down or to campaign against the establishment of wind turbines. We work with the community where the community are at, so it's not up for us to have a policy on that. The big issue for a lot of the community that we were working with on this particular issue was this was being opposed from them from outside. So an absentee landlord, someone who owned land, who lived far away, had decided this was a fantastic development opportunity for themselves. But it was imposed upon the community. There was a huge backlash in the community for these wind turbines going in because it was in an industrial scale on an area of outstanding natural beauty. A big part of our work with that community was about enabling them and empowering them to have their voice at the planning table, about supporting them in their campaign and their lobbying, supporting them to be within their governance of their own constitutions and within the charitable law, but also then about enabling dialogue in the community, getting rid of some of the huge myths that came around wind turbines and some of the, I might suppose, more crackpot theories that were there, and coming down to bare facts and bones and helping them to present their case in a very logical way. We didn't do it all, but as an organisation, part of our role was around supporting them to differentiate good information, poor information, data sharing, where they could access information and how they could gain trust and support from others in their community. Also encouraging the group to have good, strong dialogue in their own community about this change that was being imposed upon them, and space for people who were of opposing views, who long after whatever happens or whatever the outcome would be, that community has to live together. And, you know, the fundamental rule in community development is to do no harm. It's a hugely important part of what we do. So trying to understand that people come at these things from different perspectives and different ideals, and encouraging there to be good, strong, honest dialogue in communities, but then understanding that not everybody's going to be happy with whatever the outcome is, but then how can a community live together beyond that campaign and beyond that lobbying? And that's all about providing the right capacity and the right support to those communities. And that's the role of organisations like all of ours, which is not about saying to the person, you must take up a role as a politician, or you must, you know, achieve this, or you must do that, whatever. But it's about supporting people to reach their potential and support them to get there, but to support them to get there in a way that doesn't cause harm to them or the people that they're representing.
We've covered there, you know, a lot of challenges that are faced by rural communities and the ways in which they can be addressed from a multitude of different approaches, whilst taking in multiple perspectives, while taking in, you know, challenges that are faced by different people and different groups of people. Looking ahead of, I guess, of facing challenges and of taking them on and of battling through them in a sense, I wonder what you could imagine as sort of a thriving, a flourishing rural community to look like, you know, how moving beyond those challenges and kind of getting to a place where we can really build up rural communities to be in that kind of sense of thriving. I guess it's something that's come a little bit after the pandemic, or during the pandemic, is that, for example, you know, we've seen people who are working from home more. We've seen the need to be able to support those people who are working from home, who are perhaps spending more time in their communities, and people who are moving away from urban centres into rural areas. And we're addressing certain new challenges whenever that's happening. But yes, looking towards a kind of a future point where we have that kind of success achieved, and what could that kind of look like, and what are the kind of characteristics that you would really hope to see in that kind of situation? And I'll open that up to any of you as we go into our final few minutes.
I suppose for me, it's all about people, and we've heard a lot about technology and digital, and it has brought a lot of opportunity throughout COVID. But for me, it is about people. It's about supporting people. It's about resourcing people, but it's about listening and listening to women. And when we're talking about government departments or whoever it is, a lot of our organizations were deemed essential during the pandemic. And this is a point that I'll often make. We were deemed essential, providing essential services. So if we're essential during a pandemic, we are still essential as we address the issues that are happening for rural communities, particularly for women in rural communities. So I think my message would be for departments to listen, to really, really hear what is being said on the ground, And for us to really think about people in all of this, that we can talk about digital, we can talk about broadband, but it is the people, the women within our communities that are going to really be the ones that are going to affect change with the right resources and the right supports around them. Now, I think it's a miracle that we've all sat here for nearly an hour and nobody has really mentioned funding. It's usually the first thing we talk about. But resources are key, and we have to say it. We have to be resourced to do this work. And the work that a lot of organisations like ourselves have done in the last 2 years, never mind the previous 10, 15, 20 years, but particularly the last 2 years, it has been a tremendous workload. And it's not something that's sustainable into the future. We need resources and we need people to be resourced, and we need sufficient support and resources to be able to transform that change, because we can't do it on our own.
I'm glad that you mentioned that point, Tara, because I literally just written down sustainable access to funding, because that's a big issue for community groups. And so I myself am not from a rural community, but I've spoken with rural women, and something that they tell me in terms of connectivity is not just technology, but also access to public transport, so that they're able to leave the car at home, especially on student, or especially women who are on a low income. I was speaking with one a few weeks ago, and she was having to make the decision whether to put fuel in her car or oil in her tank. And we need to, when we're looking at a global climate change and climate emergency, we need to also be looking at these old networks that we had, you know, before both rail and bus routes, and relook and see how we can make sure that rural networks and rural areas are connected to the same access for transport as well.
I think we've kind of come right round there to, I guess, looking at looking forward, how we can actually sustain our communities, and the topic of funding is something we haven't perhaps gone to a lot of detail, but is of course essential in that. And I guess what we've also looked at is how those voices must be heard and must be built up and must be brought to the table in discussions of rural issues. And the ways that that's currently being achieved through organisations like Rural Community Network or Long for Women's Link, and the way that kind of collaboration between different organisations through structures like the new Common Charter can really build up possibilities for success in addressing challenges for rural communities. So thank you to all of our guests for joining us today, to Kate Clifford and Tara Farrell and to Emma Shaw. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. It's been very insightful, and we hope to see you again soon. And thank you very much for listening today.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Across Divides. Learn more about today's topic and find opportunities to get involved at icommunityhub.org. iCommunity is a joint initiative of The Wheel and NICFA and is supported by the Northern Ireland Department for Communities, the Department of Foreign Affairs Reconciliation Fund, and the Shared Island Unit in the Department of the Taoiseach.